Thank you. I want to start with an advert and mention that way in the back there's a table with a lot of materials, but I want to highlight three pieces. One is this piece that talks about the mobilization in Washington in April and gives you a lot of information about different ways in which you can get involved. Our presence here this evening is actually the success of one of the things that is suggested here, which is speaking to or people coming to talk about the issues. There's also information about how to organize a global justice film festival, including how to get a kit that the network has put together that is available to you. And then the rest of it is about the activities that are happening in Washington at the end of April. And I'll come back to this in a minute. This booklet called Empty Promises, the IMF and World Bank, and the Planned Failures of Global Capitalism. It is our thesis or analysis that, in fact, for a long time, people have been talking about the failures of the World Bank and the IMF, and we have evaluated them on the basis of, you know, they have a mission to alleviate poverty, they say, and they're not doing that, and we say you're failing, but actually they're quite succeeding in terms of what their ultimate goal is, because nothing else seems to make any sense after 60 years, the kind of things that they have done. They say insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. They've been doing the same thing over and over and over and getting the same results and claiming that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. So I strongly recommend this. It's something that we did in partnership with a lot of groups from around the world. And then the last thing is a special issue of the New Internationalist magazine. And it's quite an amazing magazine. And one of the things that they have done in the past, as they have done with this issue, is to take on a specific subject and devote the entire magazine to it. It's an independent magazine. We suggested that they cover the 60th anniversary and these institutions. It includes an interview with Joseph Stiglitz. Before I get to the bulk of my speech, I want to say two things. Call your attention to the demands that are in this flyer that I highlighted to you. And I just want to very quickly read through them, because I think they really represent both a very sharp and articulate expression of some of the things that we are calling for or that we are demanding of the institutions. But they also are just a beginning in terms of the huge issues and the huge influence that the institutions have. And the first demand is to open the meetings of the World Bank and the IMF to the media and to the general public. They meet in secret. And in the case of their board meetings, you know, for the IMF, they've moved from releasing board meetings minutes after 30 years to 5 years. That's what they call progress. Mm-hmm. And we're saying that it needs to be in the open. We need to know what they're deciding. To cancel debt, 100% of the debt, using their own resources, not to continue to demand taxpayer money from around the world to cancel debt, because this is a sham that they have. They have a debt relief initiative that demands that actually people pay that they don't get to pay. They screwed up on a massive, massive level, but they get to get off scot-free. The third demand is an end to policies that hinder people's access to food, to clean water, shelter, healthcare, education, etc., that was mentioned. This idea that they have the answer, and the answer is these economic policies that are about privatization, about charging poor people for all kinds of services. And lastly, to end all World Bank support for socially and environmentally destructive projects, oil, gas, and mining, and which is where their plans for Iraq become very relevant. And then we end by recognizing the urgency of the HIV/AIDS crisis and the role that these institutions have played. You know, we structure adjustment programs for 20 years now. They have created a situation where, by the time the pandemic hit, especially in Africa, healthcare systems, the clinic, you know, sort of village level clinic and hospitals up to the national levels had been completely decimated. The World Bank has talked about being the world's largest funder of HIV/AIDS programs and HIV/AIDS treatment, but they do so by lending money to governments, and they've done that for a long time, which means that they're creating more debt, and the system becomes self-perpetuating. That countries are indebted, and they're having to take on these policies, and then. Beyond the demands, take on something else that was mentioned by the previous speaker, and it is what is happening in terms of the economic policies and the imperial plans of the Bush administration and the other powers that rule the world today, the access to cheap oil, et cetera, to remember. Because I think we talk about this, but we don't necessarily always make the connection, that this oppressive economic policy, this imperial plan of the Bush administration and the rest of the world political and economic powers does benefit us. It benefits us as people living in the United States, as people who are consumers of all kinds of things, goods and services in the United States, as people who are dependent, on oil, who are dependent on cheap goods, who are dependent on cheap labor. And so as we think about what the imperial power, the imperial plans mean, we need to remember that we are beneficiaries of it and to be aware of that. And I think that it brings us back to where the previous speaker ended by saying, we need to be working for change. We need to be working for justice. And so I want to mention those few things and then talk a little bit about the World Bank and the IMF. And I think that, there's a lot of things that most of the people who are here know about these institutions. You're here because you have an understanding and you have a kind of analysis or a criticism of the institutions. And I thought that maybe the way to do it this evening is to talk a little bit, this being March and Women's History Month, Women's History Month, that to look at what globalization, to look at what the policies of these institutions mean for women around the world. Both in the United States, but also in other, especially in other countries, because I think that it's one lens, it's one entry point in terms of the impact of the policies of these institutions. And I ask the moderator to give me warning as I get close to the end of my time, in terms of my speaking this evening. So I want to start by talking about Washington, D.C. We live in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, which is taxed and unrepresented in the United States Congress, and which I think that there is a real parallel between how the U.S. Congress dictates to the District of Columbia in similar ways that the IMF and the World Bank dictate to countries in the Global South. It may surprise you to know, but it might surprise you to know that often decisions that are taken by the citizens of Washington, D.C., who vote or through their elected representatives at the City Council, are overturned. Or forced, if they're not overturned, the City Council is forced to reevaluate by threats from the congressional committee that has oversight in D.C. And in the last couple of years, one of the things that has happened has been the privatization of D.C.'s last public hospital, about 100 years old public hospital in D.C. that was privatized and that left about 65,000 people, uninsured people, without services. And that fight continues, and for the most part, it is led by women in D.C. who make up the majority of the uninsured. The World Bank, you know, at the time that we were founded in 1994, the World Bank was boasting about what they had done for the world, what kind of development they had been involved in, taking out ads in the New York Times, in the Financial Times, in the Washington Post. But the campaign came up because there were so many people from around the world who wanted to tell a different story and who had a different story to tell. Among them, the people of the Narmada Valley in India, led by women who 18 years ago, they were forced out of their communities, they were driven out, they were drowned out of their homes and communities to make way for a World Bank-initiated dam. The World Bank was eventually forced to withdraw from the project. But, you know, the dam has gone forward because, of course, the Indian government was not about to give up on the project and other people were willing to step up. Similarly, in Guatemala, the Chichoy Dam, in the Rio Negro Valley, where 400 villages were massacred to make way for a World Bank-funded project. In the year 2000, in April of 2000, around the mobilization, I had the privilege of meeting a man by the name of Carlos Chen, and he's from this village that was massacred. There were just a few people from the village who escaped, people who happened to have been in the forest working or outside the village at the time. And he was one of them. And he travels with a big white sheet with the name of every man, woman, and child from his village who was massacred. And he has their names printed, and then he has his handprints in red, symbolizing bloody hands. And it was a World Bank-funded dam that was, the Chichoy Dam was a World Bank-funded dam. And the Guatemalan military went into this community to clear them out, because they had refused to leave, to clear them out to make way for the dam. Indigenous women around the world, farmers in the Midwest, farmers in Haiti and the Philippines, the campesinas in Nicaragua and Honduras, landless workers in Brazil, and the rural women of Africa, many of them who have lost their ability to grow food and to feed their families because under structural adjustment programs of the World Bank and the IMF, the credit has been taken away because the only money available is money if you're going to grow coffee or tobacco or tea for as a cash crop for export. Because part of the economic model that the World Bank and the IMF have been pushing around the world has been about exporting, raising hard currencies, dollars and yen and pounds and euros now, in order to service the debt. And this has been done to the exclusion of anything else, any other kind of agricultural, productive agricultural activities that countries might be able to engage in. Killing, decimating, destroying livelihoods and food security. And of course, tied to that, an issue that I know is very very much alive in Vermont is the issue of the corporate control of seeds and other kinds of and genetic engineering, where this is part of what is happening around this question of sustainable agriculture, is that there is corporate control of seeds and genetic engineering being introduced. On the issue of HIV/AIDS. Where women, especially, are very much affected by the pandemic. When you hear the World Bank talking about being the world's largest funder of HIV/AIDS programs and treatment, they don't talk about how they are doing this by supporting the big pharmaceutical companies. You know, it may surprise you to know, assuming that the crowd here is quite well informed, that there is a difference, a huge difference. Actually, the difference being $10,000 to $15,000 a year per patient versus $350 a year per patient in terms of whether treatment comes from the big pharmaceutical companies, or it comes from generics that are produced by India, Thailand, and Brazil. And the World Bank has been very much about supporting World Trade Organization rules. And under World Trade Organization rules, with, you know, limited possibilities that have not yet been realized, the story is that, you know, the big pharmaceuticals have a right to make a profit, and it doesn't really matter how many people die from the pandemic. Compare that kind of a position in terms of developing country governments with a position taken by the U.S. government and Canada during the anthrax attacks. At a time where one person had died, both Canada and the U.S. had declared that they would not respect Cipro's patent for, or Bayer's patent for Cipro, because the anthrax attacks presented as a severe or a serious public health threat. Developing country governments are not allowed to take that kind of a position, to assume the responsibility to treat their people. In Africa, 8,000 people die every single day, and yet, for profit, that and an economic policy and an approach to access to treatment through the World Trade Organization is supported by the World Bank and the IMF. And especially for the World Bank with its declared mission to alleviate poverty. Let me also mention the fact that there are women who, there's a campaign that we've been working on and that has been highlighted called Break the Chains Campaign, and it's about supporting women who come under very special visa allowments that people who work at the World Bank and the IMF and the UN receive. And it allows them to bring domestic workers, people who can come and be nannies for their children, etc. And many of these women are exploited. They are exploited in the sense that arrangements are made. You know, to give you an example of one actual case of a World Bank employee who went from Ethiopia, who made an arrangement with the father of a young woman to bring her to the U.S. to work as a domestic worker, to work for them in their home as a maid or as a nanny. Now, in Ethiopia, the arrangement to be paid $100 a month is incredible. It's a lot of money. Most people don't make that kind of money. And so the arrangement is made between the employer and the father of the young woman. She comes to the United States, she comes to Washington, where by law she should be paid at least minimum wage. But, you know, the father doesn't know that, she doesn't know that, and she has no rights. She is told that she cannot, you know, her passport for one is taken away from her. Of course, her visa is dependent on her continued employment by this particular family. And she's also told that she can't talk to strangers. She can't go to church, or she can't go anywhere by herself. She was being forced not only to take care of the children of the family, but they actually kind of started a daycare center where their friends and neighbors would bring their kids. This young woman was waking up at about 5 every morning, working all day, taking care of these kids. The family was being paid for childcare by the people who were bringing their children. And she would work from about 5 o'clock every morning until about 11 o'clock. And there is a campaign to support all these kinds of women who, not just by the World Bank and the IMF, but also UN agencies have similar arrangements. And it is really tragic to see how women within the global economy and under the World Bank IMF economic model, women's reproductive and productive capacities are on the chopping block. Their rights, you know, as productive people, their ability to work, whether they're working on the farm, whether they're working in sweatshops, is part of the equation. Their exploitation is part of the equation. And if they're in another way, their reproductive capacity, we know, I'm sure you're familiar with the examples of sexual trafficking of women. You are familiar with the cases of male older brides child prostitution, especially of young girls. This is the economic model that these institutions have brought forward to us. And it is an economic model that, as I said in referring to the previous speaker, is very much about our own comfort and our own ability to get cheap goods, whether we are talking about bananas from Guatemala and Honduras or whether we are talking about what kinds of products are at Walmart or Co. or, I don't know, JCPenney or any number of the other kinds of companies. I want to end by maybe doing a really bad job of kind of bringing this all together with a number of quotes, because I think that there are other people who have spoken about these issues and who have made the links in very, very eloquent ways. It is not very often that that I quote Thomas Friedman, but or the New York Times for that matter, but when he talked about the hidden hand of the market, he had a certain eloquence and a certain honesty that one does not often find from these people who are putting forward the arguments for the empire and for the ruling class. He said, "The hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas. And the hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley's technologies to flourish is called the U.S. Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps." And as we look at Iraq, perhaps as the most blatant and clear example, this is quite laid bare in ways that we haven't seen before. We are here, let me conclude by saying, we are here 10 years after the first conference that really put these issues on the table. I was talking to Christopher Kaufman, who was one of the lead organizers for that conference then. And he said to me, you know, this room was filled 10 years ago. And I cannot help but wonder why it's not full tonight. But one of the things that I know for sure, as I know that my name is Joki, I was born in Kenya and I'm a black woman and will die a black woman, is that in terms of this struggle, there are more of us who are involved in it. There's no question about it. It is very clear in terms of any number of activities that we are involved in, perhaps not tonight, exemption, that there are more and more people who are writing letters, who are calling our offices, who are turning up, and who understand what the connection is in terms of all the things that are going on the political arena and going on the economic arena. And so I want to end with a quote from March Piercy, because I believe it is absolutely true about the global justice movement. It is absolutely true about the peace movement. When she said, "It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and you know who you mean, and each day you mean one more." And so our job is to make sure that as we make our way down to Washington, D.C., for April 21st to the 25th, for the World Bank IMF mobilization and the March for Women's Lives, we each bring one more person, two more people, and we take a stand for global justice. We take a stand for women's lives and for women's rights in a profound and public way that leaves no doubt in the minds of the people who will be watching, who will be listening to our voices, that we do care about justice and we care about dignity. Thank you.